Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Got a gamer. We're going to try and go through just about all the games that we watched tonight. I think we're going to get to all of them in some detail, except for San Antonio and Minnesota. And then we also got plenty of news to get to, starting with this Demo situation where he's not reporting. Our sponsors today, the June Oven, basically out of sci-fi. You put the food in the oven, a camera recognizes what it is and cooks it perfectly for you. You can use that cap space code to get $100 off the June Oven. And then also the Naked 3D Body Scanner, the world's first home body scanner. Find out more about them, naked.fit, FIT/capspace. So Danny, I did a little poll on Twitter about on these nights whether we should do news first or do the games first. Maybe it's because we had not quite as marquee of a slate of games tonight, although that certainly has never deterred us on this show. But let's get to news first. What we got?
Monty Unis is by far the biggest piece of news, especially considering that what's happening is basically, as far as I can think off the top of my head, unprecedented. So what happened is the Nets made an offer sheet, 4 years, about $37 million. The Rockets waited, and then I think it was middle of the day on Monday, because they had until the end of Monday, they matched it. So then Monty Unis has a couple days to get in, take the physical, and have everything, because the physical is still one of the requirements to make the deal work. And
yeah, he has until Thursday.
And he basically just said, I'm not taking the physical. I'm not showing up.
Yeah, and BJ Armstrong, who has been in the news a little bit recently, said essentially, you know, we know our rights, and he will not be reporting. Now, of course, the CBA framers may have anticipated that a restricted free agent didn't want to have his contract match and didn't want to have to go back to his team. So there are very, very severe consequences if you refuse to take the physical. Houston now will have one of two options. They can either leave the first refusal exercise notice in place, basically that their notice that they are matching it. So that's essentially they're leaving the contract in place. And they basically have it now so that he's treated as being under contract. So they can fine him for not reporting if they want to. And he's locked into this contract. He now has a contract because they have matched it. He signed it with Brooklyn. They matched it. He now has that contract with Houston. The other option for the Rockets to do is to say, hey, he hasn't reported. This whole contract is void now. We didn't want to pay you this much to begin with. Although, as we've noted, that this is actually not that bad of a deal for them. There is that issue of the guarantee in the summer that becomes effective March 1st. So if they wanted to say, hey, we're going to even put the screws to you even more here, presumably Demo signed the best deal that he could possibly get in restricted free agency. Now everyone knows that the Rockets have matched that deal. So if he goes back into restricted free agency, the other teams that might have considered signing him, they're probably not going to unless they up their offers significantly. And presumably they weren't willing to do that if they went with the Nets offer. And there, who else is out there really who's going to sign him to something other than I think Philly is the only one who has like $9 million in space. Is there anybody else who has the money to sign him to $9 million right now? The Jazz, they're not going to do it. So
probably not. Maybe.
Well, they're saving that money for George Hill or Favors or a trade or what. I mean, they've got a billion bigs on that team. They don't. So now, I mean, the idea that you're going to get some other contracts that's as good as this one is that's not going to happen for you. And he also cannot go to the Nets for 1 year in any way. The Nets now, it's not like the Nets can then just sign him to another offer sheet. The whole idea of this is to prevent him from doing exactly what they're trying to do right now. And the rules are very clear. So that's one option. And then what's the other one?
That this whole dance continues and he stays in this restricted free agent stasis. And if he doesn't sign a contract this year with anybody, then he becomes a restricted free agent next season.
Yeah. And I think there's even an issue, as Albert Random was tweeting, he's treated now as being under contract with the Rockets. He can't really even probably go play in Europe. He's not going to be able to get a FIBA clearance letter because he's under contract with the Rockets. So they can fine him.
And the league can also go after him because this is like contract detrimental to the league. There's a lot of other potential things that I don't think are going to be open, but the possibility is there.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what that would be, but it's really not a great situation. And allow me to go in on this for a little bit here because I have to say at this point, like BJ Armstrong, I don't know a lot of agents personally. All we have to judge them on are their public actions. But BJ may do great things behind the scenes in terms of like getting endorsements, that kind of stuff. But you look at some of his advice really hasn't been great. The way he has handled Derrick Rose's public image, and it's well before his legal issue, that civil suit this year, you know, just all the stuff with when he was going to come back and the injuries and stuff, that all could have been handled way, way better from a PR standpoint, from an advice standpoint. Somehow he managed not to get Draymond Green a max contract. I don't know how the heck he managed that. That's pretty incredible considering everyone knew the cap was going up and he wasn't considered one of the best 20 players in the league then, but he certainly was well worth the max given where the league was going in terms of the cap. And now this with Demo, first of all, the offer sheet that he signed was bad. We talked about that on the 15 and 60, if you're interested in our thoughts there. It's at the 38-minute mark of that on how he allowed them to put on basically these two non-guaranteed years at the end that are just going to be essentially prisons for Demo if he does play as well as he clearly hopes that he can. There's still this issue with the back, and now that has scared teams off. That's not entirely his fault, but again, something that maybe could have been managed a little bit better. And now he's doing this, and there's no end game here. Other than just, hey, if you are squeaky enough, you're going to get some grease. But I don't even think the only way that he could do better at this point, at least this year, Philly's not going to sign him, right? Because they have a million bigs already. He's kind of a center. They have Ilyasova, who does what he does for this year anyway. They have a ton of bigs going forward after this. If four viable centers on the roster, which is amazing, as you noted. Like, what could he possibly do? Do you think that the Rockets will just void this and give him a better deal when he's under contract now? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. Is he just like going to rehab his back and it's going to look better when he takes a physical next summer? It's
when the Rockets still match, yeah, and he loses all the money from this year.
Or does he think that he's going to be a restricted free agent, not get any offers? The first refusal exercise notice will just expire on March 1st if he just never reports. And then if he goes back into restricted free agency, maybe he's thinking that the Rockets will want to do something else and they just won't want to keep his cap hold on the books, and then they'll have to withdraw his qualifying offer next summer. Maybe that's like your absolute best case scenario, but it's really, you know, but he's going to still be getting fined this whole time. They're like, people who are smarter than him put in this system to not allow him to do this and not gain an advantage with this, and I just don't understand how he possibly is going to be able to. And then you throw in his comments too with Draymond's whole thing where he's saying like, oh, the league has never done anything to improve the game, which is ridiculous. It's a far better game now than it was in BJ's time. Just not someone I've been very impressed by recently.
I'm also concerned by the idea of BJ's made some broad statements as a part of this against restricted free agency, and maybe he has a point, but this is not the way to do that, because you're using a human being who hasn't made that much money as a professional basketball player as a functional pawn in that. He has, Monty Yunus has almost zero benefit from this. He has an immense amount of downside, both personally and professionally, because this is the type of thing, walking away from a team that has followed the rules and matched your offer, you know, everyone's done what was collectively bargained. And this is the reason you have a collective bargaining agreement, is so that rogue agents cannot do whatever they want. And you have to make sure that everyone plays by the rules, that everyone does this. And the person who is taking the most risk is Monty Yunus. It's not BJ Armstrong. It's him. And I hope that he knows what he's getting into, because, of course, the agent is serving at his discretion. You know, it's his decision to make these choices. Eventually, it does go down to Demo. And he's going to face some very real consequences if by Thursday this doesn't clear itself up. And you brought up the issue of that Brooklyn can't get back into this. But is another team really going to tie?
For a year, by the way, they couldn't. Yeah. Brooklyn can't even sign him next summer now. Yeah.
Yeah. They can't sign him next summer. Is another team really going to say this guy's worth it? Oh, and the other contract term that I have to discuss, I don't know all of the details with it, but I do know enough to say the basic point here, which is that there were certainly a fair amount of money in Monty Yunus's contract, in his offer sheet, that do not count as principal terms. And then the Rockets can basically just say no. And a fundamental rule of negotiation in restricted free agency is you don't make anything in that group, because if the other team matches, you don't get any of that money. Like that just comes off the board. They can just exit out. It's kind of like a line item veto, and you don't put that in if the other team has any shot of matching. And there is almost never a circumstance in the NBA where that ever happens, where the other team has zero chance of matching.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he just thought there was no chance they're going to match. Maybe that's how he outsmarted himself here. And now I will say this. we were critical. Some people were. I know Dan really was. I was a little bit less so, but it seemed inexplicable that last year with Tristan Thompson that they let the qualifying offer expire. And Tristan Thompson eventually got his money. Now, he got $2 million more than the initial offer on July 1st. You can argue about whether that was worth it or not. But, you know, it wasn't a disaster. It wasn't like they reduced their offer really badly or anything like that. So maybe there's a little bit more to it just in the relationships here that, you know, yeah, Daryl Morey is not going to want to.
There might be another offer that's out there that we don't know
maybe,
about.
Maybe Daryl Morey is not going to want to burn bridges with Wasserman, even if Wasserman, with the departure of Arntellum, isn't quite as much, quite what it was before. So maybe BJ knows more than we do. I'll give him a little bit of benefit of the doubt there that maybe we're just wrong. But certainly with all the information that we have at our disposal right now, it's not going to go very well. Let's move on to some other stuff here.
Nick Young, there were concerns that it was a much bigger issue. He has a strained calf muscle, right leg. He's out 2 to 4 weeks, and they've already been missing him.
Yeah, they actually started Brandon Ingram at point guard to try to just switch everything against the Jazz. That didn't really work that well, and they had to play Ingram a ton of minutes. Calderon is out too now. Huertas is in for him. So just the epidemic really hitting the Lakers here with Russell also out there, just running out of wing players. Other injury news, J.R. Smith had kind of a scary landing. He'd already been feeling some knee pain, but an MRI that he had after that game against the Raptors last night, which the Cavaliers won because it's the Cavaliers playing the Raptors. He is expected to be day to day with no damage in his knee. And Andrew Bogut had another kind of scary injury, a hyperextension. He's been diagnosed with a bone bruise in his right knee. I believe that's the opposite one from the one he injured in the finals. 2 to 6 weeks, I believe, was the potential prognosis for him. What else we got?
Chandler Parsons is going to miss at least one more week with his bone bruise in his left knee, and he's already missed 2 weeks. Tony Parker missed the game against the Bucks and tonight's game against the Minnesota Timberwolves. And Popovich said, I believe, I don't know which day, but I think it was today, that it could keep him out for an extended period. As is commonplace with the Spurs, we don't know what an extended period is. Also, Deion Waiters, I think this was a couple days ago, it was announced that he suffered a tear in his pectineus and he will be reevaluated.
That's his groin, yes. By the way, that's like just a very specific note there. And also, we should talk a little bit just about what a bone bruise is. Jeff Stotts had a little piece on this to educate. It's like, oh, a bruise, like, come on, just play. A bone bruise is basically like kind of on the way to a fracture, essentially. Like it's like a fracture that hasn't quite gone all the way through. It's not like a stress fracture, but it has caused like tissue changes in your bone, and it heals it basically in the same way that it heals a fracture. So it's definitely like a trauma to the bone that you just have to, there's really nothing you can do other than just rest it. If you're putting weight on it, trying to jump, like it's not going to work very well. So it's kind of a minor sounding thing that isn't really that minor, and guys with bone bruises in their ankle or their knee, like, they're usually going to miss some time if that's what's diagnosed. Derek Favors is out with one of those right now too, and it does seem like it's something that can be a thing that both lingers and gets worse unless you really can heal it to begin with. Miami, everyone is falling apart there. Still, we'll talk about their game against the Knicks. Josh Richardson still not playing with his ankle issue. He's missed, I think, 3-4 games now. Not necessarily close to returning either. Justice Winslow has missed 6 games already, maybe even 7 with tonight. With this wrist injury, it doesn't sound like he's necessarily close to returning either. They're going to be looking for a hardship exception pretty soon at this point to maybe try and sign someone else. And with some of the guys they're playing, that's probably a good idea. What else is there?
Eddie Osman, a guy who I know you really like, he met with the Cavs who own his draft rights, and he told them that he would love to come to the NBA next season.
Yeah, that was always the timeline, that it was going to be 2017 when he was drafted, I think, with the 31st pick overall in the 2015 draft. I've heard that he hasn't been developing, just from some scouts that I trust, quite as well as we would have hoped. I haven't seen him really at all since Eurobasket 2015 to comment on that. Reggie Bullock with Detroit out 2 to 4 months after that knee scope. We had talked about the scope, that's just the timeline there. Michael Carter Williams. He got his cast off on his wrist injury, but it's looking like until January before he will be back. At the initial timeline there was 4 to 6 weeks, so he's going to be quite past that. And then another guy who, you know, the rumblings are he'll be back in January is Ben Simmons. Brett Brown had an interesting interview there talking about how he's going to play point guard on offense, which I love, and then defend point guards on defense, which I don't love as much. My hope for them eventually was that because he can essentially play point guard, they could just play a bunch of wings around him who can shoot, and then they would be able to switch a lot of stuff. I mean, they signed Jared Bayless, so they won't necessarily be doing that. But him defending point guards, I don't think that's going to go so well unless the plan is just to switch all the time.
The whole reason that it's a benefit to have a guy like that is that you don't have to have them guard point guards. Like, that's, you get a big creative advantage on that. As you said, you can play a wing instead. You know, you could play a guy like Danny Green, let's say, and have them guard ones, do something like that. And, you know, hey, if you can get a bunch of guys Ben Simmons size to do it, doesn't really matter, but that's really unrealistic. And considering the absence of quality wings around the league, it's a lot easier to look for a small guy who can do what they need than a 6'6" guy, because everybody else is looking for those two guys too.
Did you hear the kitten meowing as I was complaining about Ben Simmons guarding point guards?
I did not.
Oh, well, she was. I got to train her to like start doing that on cue when some distressing piece of news comes out. A little bit more here on the injury front too. Jan Mahimi, I think, missed now his fifth straight game. He didn't play tonight against the Magic, right?
He did not.
So that's now fifth straight due to soreness in the opposite knee of the one that he had surgery on. He didn't come back in that crazy 2 to 4 week time frame or whatever it was initially. We cautioned that he wouldn't. It seems like he even came back relatively quickly. And what do you know? He had more issues, because players almost always seem to do that when they take less than 2 months. Well, so Beverly is the only guy that I can recall that hasn't had that happen. And so we'll see what happens when he, if he can make it through the season. I hope he can, because he's been essential to what they're doing. And then the Rondo suspension. He reportedly threw a towel in the direction of assistant coach Jim Boylan and was suspended for last night's game against the Blazers, which the Bulls lost. And then, of course, they also lost tonight against the Pistons, which we'll talk about. And he didn't exactly sound contrite, but he said that they had met and worked past it. But he still was like, I'm a point guard, I'm going to speak my mind, blah blah. I think he, you know, again, views this as some kind of a conflict over strategy. I mean, it'd be interesting to know whether he wanted them to do some of their strategy or whether he was just getting yelled at for the things that he himself was doing wrong and took issue with that. It'd be interesting to see that. And then we got one more thing CBA related here.
Yeah, reporting from Mark Stein, very excited about the possibility, which is that for the start of next season, the first one with full new one with the new CBA, that they're going to shorten the exhibition season and move the start of the regular season up somewhere between a week, 10 days, and that will reduce, or ideally eliminate, but it'll reduce the amount of back-to-backs the teams face. Ideally, it would reduce four games and five. It could eliminate those, but you're not going to get rid of back-to-backs with just another 7 to 10 days, but it's certainly is a nice help, and they don't need that many exhibition games.
Well, and here's the thing too, I think that by spreading it out, the national TV contract should become more valuable, because now you're still going to have national games for those first 10 days beforehand.
Sure.
And so now the league should be able to make more money. I mean, each individual team isn't going to make more gate, but there are going to be more national TV games now if there are more weeks in the season. So yeah, I think they should make more money, and hopefully players will have less back-to-backs, less 4 and 5s, etc. And yeah, all right, that's all we got on that. We'll get to the games here in a moment, but first this from the June oven. The June oven is a convection oven. It's about twice the size of a toaster oven, so definitely big enough to cook a full meal in there for 4 people or so, if that's what you want to do. It heats up almost instantaneously. It takes 3 seconds for the heating elements to get to full power. And there are a number of multi-step cook programs for basically anything under the sun that you want to cook. You put the food in and it recognizes what it is automatically and gives you a choice of potential programs to use, or you can just have it do it all on its own. There's a meat thermometer that attaches to the oven as well, so it knows exactly when it's done cooking, and then that heating element turns off immediately and you can be done. You don't have to worry about, hey, the oven is 450 degrees. Yeah, we turn the heating element off, but it still stays 450 degrees and overcooks our food. It also sends you a push notification to your phone telling you when it's done. So you're also going to note that. If you're someone who wants to look a little bit more manually, you can even activate the camera on your smartphone, see what the food looks like as it's cooking it. If you disagree with the automatic program, you can take it out if you want. There's a ton of ingenious features as well. There's even the top of the oven is a scale as well to weigh your food if you need to. And the June oven also gets better over time because it's constantly taking more input from users of recipes. They're adding more recipes all the time, and it just gets smarter and smarter the longer you own it. If you are one of our listeners who's kind of in bachelor mode and you're not really a great cook, but maybe you want to cook someone dinner, the June oven will allow you to do that very easily. And it's so awesome too that it's a pretty sweet conversation piece because it's basically out of sci-fi. We are the only marketing affiliate right now for the June Oven that I am aware of. So you can use that Capspace code, get $100 off at JuneOven.com. Just go check it out. They have a bunch of videos on there, a bunch of reviews too, talking about how cool this is, more stuff about how it works that we can't get into, you know, a minute and a half ad like this. But JuneOven.com, use that Capspace code, let them know that you came from us, and you'll get $100 off. Where do you want to go first in terms of these games?
I personally would want to go to Wizards Magic, but we can go wherever you want.
Yeah, let's do that first. It was first temporarily, John Wall put up 52. I actually didn't get a chance to watch any of this other than just John Wall's shots to see how it was that he was able to put up that 52. So I'll leave most of this to you here. I mean, the number one question just looking at the box score to me is Orlando is one of the worst offenses in the league. How the hell did they put up a buck 24 on the Wizards?
They got a lot better shots than they usually do and hit a much higher proportion. So Jody Meeks was nailing his threes. He just recently got back from injury. And it almost knocked me over, but Elfrid Payton started the game hot. He had 8 points in the first quarter and just did the last couple minutes. And then he played the whole second, had another 14. He had his career high by the end of the third quarter. And I didn't see it as much as an issue of like, oh, John Wall's defense was bad, but there were issues with help and Payton was just making shots that he normally misses. So that was a part of it. They were also, the contests weren't great. The Magic also got to the line a lot, which is unusual for them. You know, they're not the greatest team for that. Some of that was you know,
one of the worst
loosey
in the league,
goosey.
In fact.
Yes. A little loosey-goosey with fouls on Biyombo at one point when they were trying to make the comeback. But I think it gets a little bit lost. Oh, and also, yeah, so they're 12 of 26 from three overall as a team. 46%, much, much better than they usually do. But I wanted to kind of note how significant, or at least historically, it is to have a game where somebody scores 50 or 52 points in a home loss. 52 plus in a home loss has only happened 26 times, including tonight, in NBA history. There's a reason for that, because scoring 52 is really hard at home and losing. Wall had a very good game, and a lot of that was different. The Magic have played much better defensively, particularly since they put Biyombo in, but Wall had a game that reflected the offensive ideal that many of us have had for him since he was drafted. He was making the shots that he's missed basically his entire career. In the pick and roll, the Wizards have a bunch of excellent screeners, and usually he uses that to create some space and then he makes the pass. He and Gortat have beautiful chemistry. In this game, there were a few of those. There were only 16 makes, though, by the other Washington starters. He had 8 assists, not too bad. But Wall was taking those shots and making them, and a fair amount of them were listed as contested, but they weren't close enough to really affect the shot that much.
Yeah, he was definitely hitting his three-pointer really well from downtown. 5 out of 8, got to the foul line for 14 attempts, 18 out of 31, had 3 steals, 8 assists. His defense can't have been that good if Elfrid Payton was making his first 9 shots. Again, you know, Payton and Meeks combined to go 7 out of 8 from three. You're not going to see. Meeks had 18 points on only 9 shooting possessions. Pretty good performance. I think the reports were, and part of why we slammed the Magic for acquiring him, the reports were that he basically might not play this year. He had another surgery on that foot after, I think, re-breaking his Jones fracture as he tried to come back for the Pistons down the end of last year. But if he's healthy and he can give them, it's been a couple of lost years for him, if he can give them anything like what he gave the Pistons in 2014-15, he's going to really help this team as just somebody who can make a shot off the bench could open things up for them so much like it did tonight. And, you know, the 12 out of 26, that's not really any more attempts than Orlando normally gets up. They're right about the league median in attempts, which actually is a surprise. They don't hit any of them, but they actually get them up. So I don't know that aspect of Washington's defense would have been that terrible.
Well, one other thing I want to mention.
The fouling is the disappointing thing to me, to get 36 free throw attempts for this team.
Yeah, 36 free throw. That's a big thing. And also, this game was a perfect storm of two different dynamics that have been going on for the last couple weeks. One is Washington's bench has just been horrible, and Elfrid Payton's first stretch
that's been going on since the start of that's been going on since like the entire John Wall era.
And so how that mattered in this game beyond how it matters normally is that Orlando in the last week has put two of their better players on the bench. You know, that Elfrid Payton's coming off the bench, Nick Vucevic is coming off the bench. So with Mihinmi out, they don't have the same center defense, they don't have the same interior, and those guys are tired. They play John Wall the entire first quarter, something I still don't love for point guards, because especially when they have a lot of strain. So they got to get into a rhythm, and they, once the Magic built a lead, they didn't really, it never got all the way back. And I cracked up a little bit. I don't take any joy in Washington suffering, especially as somebody who has covered that team for periods of time. But I lost it a little bit when in the fourth quarter, the Wizards finally started coming back and they cut the lead. It was 12 at halftime. It went up to, I think, 15, maybe even a little higher than that. They got it to 9, I think two or three separate times. And every time it was like Sideshow Bob stepping on a rake, something super weird would happen. And then the lead would go back up to 11. Bradley Beal missed a wide open breakaway dunk. They had one. They had another one where like the ball bounced off Gortat. He accidentally handed the ball to Vooch, who laid it in. Like, it was just one. They weren't going to win the game anyway, probably, but they just could not get out of their own way when they had done a decent enough job getting back into it.
The 52 points also really overstates how good Wall was in this game. He did play for 42 minutes, and Trey Burke played the other 6 minutes at point guard. No Satoransky, which was a surprise to me. I didn't hear anything about him being injured. He's been their best small off the bench, at least in terms of plus minus so far this year. But a lot of it was in the last 3 minutes of the game when they were down 10 and kind of giving up layups, and he was just the Magic didn't seem to be trying that hard on a lot of these. But it was interesting to see that how unstoppable he can be when he's even coming close to hitting his jumper. I mean, he even hit a couple of jumpers going to his left, which he never does. He always shoots going to his right in this game. But he had this one pullback move on Serge Ibaka, where if you can even get the guy thinking that you're going to shoot a jumper if you're John Wall and advancing forward even a step, he can just blow by the guy to his left. I mean, he loves to drive left, and so when you do a step back to your left, that sets that move up, and he just blew past Ibaka before anyone could get there to help. Maybe his jumper will continue to turn the corner. He's been so much better offensively this year in terms of his efficiency. But man, he really seems to have taken a step back defensively. From I didn't watch this game, but the other games that I've seen, it's he does like he'll get beat on the pick and roll and then try to do like the matador, like reach around, poke the ball away from behind play. He does that like 10 times a game. And instead of just like trying to compete and get over the screen, which he's actually really good at, uses length to potentially bother the shot from behind, or at the very least, like veer back into the path of the big so he can't hit the ball to the roll man. His effort has not been as good. And this Washington team, highlighted by giving up this $124 to one of the worst offenses in the league, they're not going to win this way unless they can really significantly improve the defense. Maybe Mihinmi helps a little bit, but Wall, you know, I know he's scoring a lot this year, but they need more from him defensively, because Porter is not a great defensive player. Beal isn't a great defensive player. Gortat isn't. Like, somebody is going to have to do
work
here defensively. Yeah.
Wall has been disappointing on that end, certainly. And also, you'll notice in my little summary of how he was doing well, Bismack Biyombo was not very much involved in that. It was more on Vooch and other guys, because Biyombo is generally a very good pick and roll defender. He's their most active big man in that way. Ibaka is certainly talented, but Biyombo, the only highlight he was really in was the last score that John Wall had when he had a really nice and one on him, but the game was already settled at that point.
Let's get to Chicago and Detroit now. Detroit was waxing the Bulls early, and then Jimmy Butler fueled a huge run down the end of the second quarter, early third, and the Bulls were actually able to tie it, you know, as the game was going through the 60s and 70s. And then Butler went out, and immediately Detroit went on a 6-0 run. That turned into a 12-0 run after he came back in. He only sat for like a minute and 30 seconds. Hoiberg just had to bring him back in because the Bulls bench has really been troubling them a lot lately, as guys like Mirotić has not been able to shoot well. Cannon hasn't been shooting that well either. He's kind of showing why lately, that he was a fringy guy in Philly who didn't even get a restricted free agent qualifying offer. Jerry and Grant was terrible against the Blazers yesterday. He hasn't been any good other than that one magical Portland game where he got a bunch of pick six steals. His jumper has been a big problem. It's really an issue for the Bulls when Jimmy Butler is to play 43 minutes on the second night of a back-to-back and you're still going to lose by 10. They can't keep Butler going like this. It is kind of funny too that, remember how like Tom Thibodeau, I can't believe how much he's playing Jimmy Butler, and guess what? He plays just as much under Fred Hoiberg, because awesome 3-and-D wings who can score and defend the other team's best player, those guys are really valuable and it's impossible to replace them in the lineup.
Wade played a combined 69 minutes the last two nights as well, which is significant.
Yeah, it was frustrating watching KCP defend him because Wade had absolutely no chance on KCP, and then he was just doing his BS fakes and getting KCP in the air and getting him to follow him. When maybe Wade in the post could have had more effect, but they didn't really get him like right down on that left block to where he can turn to the middle and go to that floater. And so if he's going to shoot a fadeaway, like just let him shoot it, KCP. But of course, you know, that wasn't good enough. KCP did have a nice game overall, but that was a little bit frustrating that he kept fouling. The other thing that was really interesting in this game was the Pistons bench performance. Reggie Jackson only played 18 minutes, was 2 out of 9. Ish Smith, once he came in, of course he was 2 out of 11. He couldn't hit a shot to save his life, but he did have 10 assists in 30 minutes, which was outstanding. Aaron Baines, John Luer, those guys actually ended up closing out the game. Darren Hilliard had a nice performance in his 17 minutes as the main backup wing off the bench. Stanley Johnson played 6 minutes in the first half, was -6. He was involved in, had 2 turnovers and 2 fouls during that period. He was involved in that big Chicago run. So Stan tried to get him back in the rotation after he got suspended. He'd been out of the rotation, and Hilliard kind of was outplaying him recently. And then Tobias Harris was the one guy who was on the floor the whole time. He was fantastic. 9 out of 16 for 22 points in this one with a +8, even though he and Marcus Morris had no chance of defending Butler. That's why they really need Stanley Johnson to evolve and become a perimeter stopper who can get big minutes on this team, because they're not going to be able to, even though they've been really good defensively this year, like they got to be able to stop a wing guy in an ISO, and Morris and Harris are not the guys to do that.
They also have 2 forwards starting that can slide to the floor, no problem. They do it, they switch all the time. So having another guy with Johnson's skill set defensively fits in perfectly. Something I wanted to ask you about, you watched more of this game than I did, was it looked like Drummond started the game really strong and then fell off. Was there something that you noticed that was particularly key to that?
I think it was, well, the big reason they put him back in and then the big reason they took him out again was just due to the hack of Drummond, which they did down the end when the Bulls were down 10 late. So I thought Drummond played just fine. It was just that 12-0 run was with the reserves in, and Stan kind of stayed with the reserves, and unlike in a lot of games where they do that, the reserves actually held on to the lead, so he kind of never really had much of a reason. He did go back to Drummond at one point, but then they did the hack out, so they took him right back out again. There was Rondo was rondoing during that big run that the Pistons had, his heroics during that time, a missed wide open layup, missed 2 free throws after a fast break. He is so bad on the fast break statistically because he overpasses, he has a ton of turnovers, you know, but just the possessions that he finishes off of fast breaks, and then he's also really bad at shooting layups, and he's never going to shoot a jumper in transition either, like a 3 or something that's going to help your stats. He had a couple of defensive mistakes where he failed to help out. He missed a floater. Yeah, like 1 or 2 nice defensive plays, but overall, like, they put him in for Butler as that run was beginning, and he was a big part of the problem. Let's see what else that I have here. Oh, the Bulls did a really nice move that I had not seen yet. One of the big things, especially with teams that switch, that we're seeing now is trying to take the point guard and get him stuck on in a switch on a LeBron James. Here they were trying to do it for Tobias Harris or Morris and get Rondo onto him. And so what the Bulls did, they did this twice that I saw. The first time they messed up because they're going to have Taj Gibson, who is guarding whoever the 4-man was, either Morris or Harris, just switch onto either Reggie Jackson or a Smith, and he can handle those guys just fine on a switch. That would have left Rondo on Harris or Morris, but they actually, as soon as the switch took place, had Rondo sprint to the corner, the opposite corner, to go get KCP on a dead run. Just as soon as the pick was set, he started sprinting to the corner, and then Jimmy Butler, who was guarding the other forward, actually raced up to go and get the guy who was setting the screen. It was a very interesting way, and it worked the second time they did it. They got the switch, and then Gibson ripped up Reggie Jackson the first time. They got a layup because Gibson didn't realize that he was supposed to switch. So that was really interesting. The other thing that we've seen strategically with that lately is, I think we talked about a little bit on the Twitter NBA show, but it got lost in all the other hubbub. The Warriors finally started doing this when they were just putting Steph in a pick and roll every single time against the Rockets on Thursday, they actually were pre-switching to put another wing on whoever was going up to set the screen. That's something that you could maybe try to do when you're using, you know, your little point guard's man as the screener. So it's the first time I think that I've really seen these type of tactics to just foil these very stagnant, hey, we're just going to run a dummy pick and roll that's not really going to go anywhere, but just get your small guy under our good score and then try to attack. I like seeing it because I think of that as being fairly unimaginative, boring offense, and anything that teams can do to outsmart that, I really enjoy seeing.
And considering how the pick and roll is becoming an even larger part of the offense, getting counters so you don't get caught in bad matchups is a natural evolution of that, and we'll see if some of those can take hold. And would you say that kind of Thibodeau's icing is another thing that was like an earlier innovation that just got consumed by everybody in the league?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't Tibbs. There are teams even doing that back in the 90s, sure. to on side pick and rolls, especially to keep the ball out of the middle. And there are a lot of things that teams now have done as a counter to that also, where you're just kind of selling out on that, you know, definitely like pick and pop big men are a big way that teams have tried to foil that. For the Pistons, Reggie Jackson, the Bulls were guarding that pick and roll with Ian Drummond 2-on-2. Robin Lopez actually was outstanding protecting the rim while the Bulls were making their run and showed a little bit more mobility than usual. But Reggie was a little bit too eager to take shots in the 15-foot range. He has an okay floater. If he's really going to get into floater range, I'm okay with him taking that shot, especially because that's usually going to come off the rim soft and it'll give Drummond a chance to go in for the offensive rebound. And part of why I think Drummond had a nice game was Reggie was hooking up with him reasonably well. Reggie did have 7 assists in his 18 minutes. But Reggie, if he doesn't really have like the type of jumper, he shoots more of a set shot where he can stop on a dime and rise up and expect to make a shot from 15 feet or 17 feet efficiently. He's got to continue to probe and get a better shot when the other team is playing him and Drummond 2-on-2 there. And then for the Bulls, Cristiano Felicio, I think this is the second night now that he has been back in the rotation. I thought that he actually had some nice plays. He still makes some rookie mistakes, but he plays with a lot of force. He's got quick feet. He has a pretty decent understanding of the angles and pick and roll. He had one really nasty block in this game too. Didn't do a ton of offensively, but I think he's still worlds better than Bobby Portis is at this point, and he should be the backup center. And
do you want to move on to Knicks Heat?
Yeah, let's take a look at that one. It really seemed like a tale of two halves for the Knicks with their shooting was the big story in this one, but they eventually put up 114 on what has been a very good Heat defense, but of course is missing some of their best guys. But they actually had still been defending really well, even with a lot of these guys, Winslow and Josh Richardson, out on their West Coast trip.
I like that you watched more of the second half and I watched more of the first half, because it's a good way of telling the story of this game. So in the first half, you can look at a game a lot of different ways, but it's one of the benefits of the eye test versus the box score, was that I watched a lot of it and just kept on sitting there going, Miami's getting lucky, basically. You know, their defense was all right. They were contesting. It wasn't like they were giving up layups that the Knicks were missing, but the Knicks missed their first 11 threes. At least half of them were open. Melo had a couple bad decisions. Porzingis missed a couple he usually makes. But there were these fundamentals where you're basically sitting there going, either the Heat are going to defend better or the Knicks are going to start making these just due to regression to the mean, law of large numbers, whatever kind of trope you want to put out there. And Miami's defense, as you said, has gotten a lot shakier as they've lost many of their good defenders. Josh Richardson, Justice Winslow both missed this game. And so I was sitting there waiting, watching the first half, waiting for the dam to break. And it didn't in the first half, but it did almost immediately in the second half, where in the third quarter, the Knicks outscored them 31-23, including 4 of 6 from 3. And I think it was 11 fast break points or 11 second chance points. I can't remember, but it was just a lot of easy offense for the Knicks.
Yeah, they destroyed them on second chance points, 31 second chance
points.
Yeah,
it was second
chance points. Joakim Noah actually had something to do with that. He had one of his good games, 5 out of 6 from the field, 7 offensive rebounds. Almost all of that was accomplished in the first half because he got 3 loose ball fouls in the first 5 minutes of the third quarter, all of which were going for rebounds, 2 on the defensive glass and 1 on the offensive glass. That was just a terrible decision. Clyde, in his infinite wisdom, he called it, his quote was, sheer folly. Now he'll have to go to the bench. described it perfectly. It was like Whiteside just easily had the rebound and Noah decided he was going to like take a swipe at it and hit his arm and committed the foul. It was terrible. And of course, he never came back in because Kyle O'Quinn actually started playing really well after that. Another big story here for the Heat. There are three good players in this game. Whiteside, Dragic, and Tyler Johnson. Those guys were a combined 26 out of 48. Everyone else on the Heat was a combined 12 for 41. Not very good. And that was even with Wayne Ellington shot 4 of 11 on threes. He actually has been playing well and provided some desperately needed modicum of shooting. But I mean, you had like Josh McRoberts. He looked spry, actually. I thought he played okay in this game. Like, he looks like he's not injured and he's having some of his best stretch in a Heat uniform. He actually looks like a real player again. He's not just gutting it out and like not really ready from injuries or just not even on the floor entirely. Derek Williams, I thought, was really bad in this one. Willie Reed only played 10 minutes. Udonis Haslem, they brought him in to try and guard Melo because they just didn't have anyone to guard Melo. It was either Rodney Magruder, who was 2 for 11 in this one, negative 12, trying to guard him, or Derek Williams. Derek Williams, not the kind of player who can translate having guarded a guy in practice for a year into actually doing a good job against him, because he's not exactly like the most locked in guy. Melo lit him up in that third quarter. He was lighting everyone up, and he was ultimately 35 points for him, 13 out of 27 from the field. It is a little concerning for Melo, though, that, again, we've talked about this a lot, that he just shoots a lot of jumpers and they'll go in for him, but he's kind of reaching that Kobe stage now where this is a great game for him. 7 free throw attempts is like the most he's going to get. He'll shoot about 50% from the field, you know, 35 points on 30 shooting possessions. That's like, you know, about average efficiency, maybe a little bit better, but those are like the good games. You know, he can't have these games where he's got like 75% true shooting percentage and he really goes off, and then, you know, his bad games, he'll just shoot 5 out of 15 and not get to the foul line at all. So he's in a different stage of his career, but he still is capable of providing a lot. And this was a game in which the Knicks didn't shoot incredibly well, only about average true shooting, but they were crazy on the offensive glass with 38% offensive rebounds. Then they only had 10 turnovers, which is very low as well in what was a relatively fast-paced game.
And it's something
I'm sorry, it wasn't a fast-paced game. It was about
it's something I'm sure we'll talk about tomorrow on the Twitter NBA show. I noticed a lot during this game that Porzingis, whenever he's involved in the action, he's just going to get open. There isn't really a cogent way to defend him
unless they switch it. And of course, now like Jennings and Rose like don't do a great job of finding him. But I agree. I mean, he getting him involved more, you're going to get good stuff for sure.
It just happens. And Jared Dubin, our friend, has talked about how Melo screening for Porzingis or vice versa just leads to one of them getting open because the team has to make choices. And so the Knicks getting more active and using their special gifts more would open it up. I also wanted to take you to task a little bit for a comment. You noted in our notes, though I don't think you're going to bring it up, that I'm rooting for most Bates threes over Hassan Whiteside assists. That is not true. I'm rooting for it to be close enough that I get to keep talking about it until the end of the regular season because I love it so much.
Whiteside actually had some nice passes in this one. He had off a steal, he dribbled down the length of the court and you're like, oh, this has charge written all over it. And then he dimed up, I shouldn't say dimed up, it wasn't that nice, but he had a pass to Dragic for a layup after he drew the defense to him and he avoided committing the charge. He had a nice pass to a cutting McRoberts. His post-ups continue to be more missed than hit. He just can't get deep enough on his jump hook. Like, he's just not strong enough to back down. He doesn't have the core strength, the leg strength to really like get into position for that hook. So he ends up kind of shooting this push shot hook from too far out. I would like to see him go more, if he can't get better position, to a turnaround jumper. He has a very nice high release, especially going to his right shoulder. He hit one like pretty nice fadeaway, which was a tough shot that's not repeatable, but I would like for him to just be like, all right, I have a 7'7" wingspan. I'm just going to jump over the top of you and a decent touch and shoot this instead of trying to get his body into the guy and then he's off balance when he goes to the hook shot. Just try to say, hey, I'm gonna jump over you instead.
I'm sure you're happy that Lance Thomas had a pretty good game.
Yeah, you're starting to see maybe with Justin Holiday seeming to work out. He hasn't been amazing, but if he hits 36% of his threes and defends okay, he can be a rotation guy for this team. Thomas, excellent off the bench, 21 minutes, 11 points, 5 of 6 from the field, hit his lone three-pointer, and he's been hitting that okay since he came back from injury. I think this is either his second or third game back. troubling for the Knicks. We should have knocked on wood when we talked about how Derrick Rose hasn't been injured yet because he had to leave this game with back spasms. Did not play particularly well. But Brandon Jennings did play pretty well in his stead. Didn't shoot it that well, but he had nine assists. Kuzminskas as well did not play at all, I think, in the second half. It was negative 13 in the first half. Thomas kind of took his minutes, as did Holiday. And then Kyle O'Quinn was a monster. 12 points, 5 offensive rebounds, 6 of 8 from the field, plus 5. And he hopefully is becoming entrenched as the backup center. Had a little conversation with someone on Knicks Twitter saying that they thought Hernan Gomez was better than him. Certainly all the games that I've watched, that hasn't been the case, and this was one of them.
O'Quinn has 15 offensive rebounds in their last 3 games, which is awfully impressive. And he had that huge one against the Wolves when he dropped 20 and 13 on them. And I like O'Quinn quite a bit. He could have been the big beneficiary of them trading Robin Lopez. Instead, they signed Joe Noah instead. But I still really like him.
Yeah, Whiteside, this was a little bit of a regression for him. I mean, he did have 23 and 14, 5 offensive rebounds, missed a bunch of free throws, only 3 out of 9. And they didn't defend really well. He wasn't that good on the defensive glass.
And the Knicks were also 21 of 29 in the restricted area.
Yeah, that's not great either. And he played 38 minutes, so he was playing most of the game. I did give him credit on the awards pod that we recorded today that's going to come out tomorrow for having improved defensively, but this today was a regression for him. Let's move on here. What we got next?
The last game of the night, I believe. Talk about the Jazz getting another one of those. It feels like every win against the Suns is a blah win, but another one of those blah wins against the Suns.
No, it was not a blowout. This looked like it was going to be a blowout win against the Suns. It actually got really exciting in the fourth quarter. I'll say, like, the Vivint Smart Home Arena, Larry H. Miller Court at Vivint Smart Home Arena was rocking down the end, which is always cool because you think that the home crowd, after they give up a big lead against a team they should beat, is going to panic, but they actually, like, really helped the Jazz through it in a game where Rodney Hood appeared to injure his knee. We don't know what is. Andy Larson actually had a good piece today complaining a little bit about the Jazz just never even releasing any kind of timetable or specifics on what these injuries are. Like, we have no idea, for example, like, when Alec Burks is going to be back or Derek Favors. And you understand why they don't want to do that. The ostensible reason, number one, is just to protect their players. I would make the argument that that actually hurts both them and the players because it just, anything that's going to lead to confusion, make it look like they're hiding something, make people more worried about players' injury situations, that's going to hurt both the perceived value of your players around the league. It's going to lead to just negative publicity for your players, and it's also going to mean that their trade value could be lower as well. So I think most teams are very honest about injuries. I don't really see the point of it for the Jazz. I mean, they are an organization that models themselves after the Spurs. Even the Spurs are a little bit more forthcoming about it than the Jazz are. So I wish they would change that a little bit. But so yeah, Rodney Hood, he went up, made a nice right-handed floater with the lefty, and he appeared to kind of come down awkwardly on his right knee. He was limping. He ended up going out of the game, but the Jazz were in control pretty much all the way through. And that was with the exception of the fourth quarter, when a Phoenix lineup of Knight, Barbosa, Dudley, Dragan Bender, and Alex Len, who then became Tyson Chandler when Len fouled out, really took it to a Jazz bench lineup. They came back very early on with Gordon Hayward and Rudy Gobert. Gobert played 38 minutes. He was wonderful in this game and was plus 20. But they still weren't able to stem the bleeding. The Suns actually came back and tied it at 103 after the Suns had a 13-1 run to start the quarter. They were up by the Jazz were up by 19 to start the quarter, and then the Suns faded. LB missed a pretty easy fast break layup that he usually puts down. He was just contested by Mac. They got a steal. It was a 2-on-1. Just rimmed that layup out, and that could have actually given them the lead. Then the Jazz came down again after Joe Johnson stole a pass intended for Jared Dudley from Knight. Knight was exhausted because he had just been running pick and roll, like, putting the Jets on in every possession, getting out on the fast break. He was totally out of gas by the end of the quarter, and so the Jazz got a run out. And then Shelvin Mack had a really nice floater over Chandler when they ran a 1-3 pick and roll, and LB was doing a nice job on Gordon Hayward, but didn't want to leave him And so Mac was able to get to the rim. And then they ran the same play again, and Mac threw this alley-oop to Rudy Gobert that he jammed reverse over Dragan Bender, who was trying to contest it as the help man on the backside. And that pretty much put the game away. But it was a nice effort for the Suns. It was one of those games where, hey, the reserve unit makes this great comeback. Do you go back to the starters, if at all? And I don't count Marquise Chris in that, because he's not one of your five best players that you would actually put in if you're trying to win games. And this is a game too. Jared Dudley was awesome in this one, that shows just how much better Dudley is than Chris. I understand why they're starting Chris for development minutes and perception, and you know, you get his minutes out of the way early, but what they started this game down 17-6 when Chris was in the game, and they're starting every game down by a lot because of that. They're not really trying to win that hard. I understand that, but it's also, that's the reality. It's just that Dudley is way better than him, and he should be starting if you're trying to win games.
I am happy that Dudley's getting minutes with Bender, because that might even be a forward combination I like better than Dudley and whoever else, like Chris or whatever.
Yeah, that's not a bad one. And Bender was 1 out of 5, but I thought he played pretty well in this game, just in his floor game. Played 28 minutes. That's probably got to be a season high for him. Dudley hit some big threes. Barbosa as well hit some big threes and had his layups in the fourth quarter. Devin Booker was actually had 21 points, but as so often is the case for him, was negative 26, and he didn't play at all really in the fourth quarter, except for one time when they were trying to get a three on like one of the last possessions as they desperately tried to come back.
Something that has flown under the radar, at least for me, I that's probably just because I'm not watching as much of the Jazz right now as I will be in the very near future, including, let's call it, a promise I made in the awards podcast that will come out tomorrow, is that Gordon Hayward during this 7-1 Jazz win streak, Tim McMahon tweeted this out, and I hadn't realized how well he'd been playing. He's been averaging in that 8-game run, 27 a game on 50-50-86, so basically 50-50-90, and 10 free throw attempts per game.
Yeah, 28 points on 22 shooting possessions for Hayward in this one, 2 of 3 on threes, 3 steals, and he and Gobert were all the Jazz had in this one. I shouldn't say that. Boris Diaw had some really nice moments, almost exclusively when he was guarded by Chris at both the beginning and end of the first half as the Jazz went on a big run. Chris trying to guard him was just a foul waiting to happen, or just like a pump fake that makes him jump 8 feet in the air waiting to happen. He just was like way too smart, way too crafty, way too, I don't even want to say strong, we'll say way too large for Chris, as perhaps a better way of putting it. Shelvin Mack was good in this game too down the stretch. He was a calming influence, had that big bucket late that I talked about. And Gobert had his career high with 22 points, 10 of 11 from the free throw line, including 2 really big free throws to help ice the game, and 4 block shots. He was plus 20, so it certainly was not at his expense that Phoenix came back in large part.
Do you have anything else on this game, or do you want to talk about another game, or just leave it where it is?
I'll talk a little bit about the end of Philly and Memphis. You and I watched yesterday when we were at the arena that Philly-Denver game, which was basically the movable force against, I don't know, there's some better way to say this, like the really slow object or whatever, I don't know, the stoppable force against the movable object, I guess would be it, with two teams who had been horrendous in the clutch. And then this, of course, was the Memphis Grizzlies, who are always unbelievable in the clutch, against the Sixers, who, as we know, are also bad in the clutch. I only watched the last 2 minutes of this one. It started with Saric, who was very effective in this one off the bench. He was playing mostly at the three, which he hasn't done much of, with Ilyasova at the four. Ilyasova played 40 minutes in this game. Saric was really abusing Troy Williams in the post on the end. He had a nice and one, missed the free throw, and then of course Philly didn't score again in the last 2 minutes. They basically, Keith Pompey, their beat writer, almost had an aneurysm because they turned the ball out turned the ball over coming out of timeouts every single time down the stretch. And so they did it twice in a row. TJ McConnell throws it away. At one point, right after that, someone tweeted at Ben Simmons, hey, you better come back soon. Like, McConnell is trash. And Ben Simmons is like, no, he had 9 assists tonight, you know, playing the good soldier. And maybe McConnell played well. As I said, only watched the last 2 minutes, but he definitely got pressured up, threw away a pass that turned into a pick six for the Grizzlies. And then they put in Rodriguez, ran a play. Rodriguez threw it away. They let Zebo get an offensive rebound to tie it up. Rashawn Holmes, who played well overall in this one, from what people I trust were tweeting at least, he fouled Marc Gasol on a pick and roll in which I don't think I've ever seen this before, that like all 5 Grizzlies players, I think, were standing inside the arc. It was a Harrison Gasol pick and roll. Harrison, was only 1 out of 9 in this one. His shooting kind of came back to earth a little bit, but it was good enough to run the team okay. At least well enough that they're able to not lose the game. And finally, on their last play, they almost turned it over again on the inbounds. Holmes lost it, but it was deemed not to have controlled it, so he's able to go pick it up near midcourt. And then they weren't able to get a three off. Then Zebo missed 2 free throws after that rebound, even though so the Sixers had another chance, and then they weren't able to hit a three there either. When Brett Brown actually set up a nice play, they inbounded the ball to Rashawn Holmes. Memphis elected not to foul, even though Holmes, not a great free throw shooter, and was inside the arc as well. And then Jamichael Green, for some reason, decided that first he was going to go and double team Rashawn Holmes inside the arc when they're up 3. Then he didn't know who he should get. He kind of got in the way of Tony Allen, who was trying to chase Stauskas around a screen. And then Stauskas was able to get wide open in the corner for the pass from Holmes. It was only Zebo. It was still a good look, but Zebo actually came off of Holmes and did a decent job of contesting Stauskas. It was a great look. And Stauskas, of course, just missed it. And the Grizzlies ended up beating the Sixers because that's just what happens with these two teams in the clutch.
Also a game where both these teams played close games last night. And also 2 shaky offenses as they've been. Both teams shot below 40% from the field in this game.
All right, we done here?
Yeah, I'll promo a few different things before we get into the bigger promo. One is you and I did a Locked On Warriors together about Warriors Pacers, Klay Thompson's 60-point game, a lot of other craziness. I also wrote my standard two pieces for The Athletic, and it's not out yet. I still need to edit it, but tomorrow my podcast for Real Jam Radio with Royce Young going for an hour on this fascinating Thunder team, which I really enjoyed going, talking about Russ, to a lot of different stuff. We go in many different directions. That will come out tomorrow.
Oh, that's I'm looking forward to listening to that one too. What Royce has to say on the dynamic around there. Twitter NBA show is tomorrow. Awesome slate, Cavs and Knicks, although the Knicks being on the second night of a back-to-back diminishes that a little bit. And then 2 rested teams, Warriors at Clippers, probably the biggest showdown the Warriors have had since opening night. I think they are certainly going to be up for this one. These games are always very entertaining. Last time these guys played in the preseason, you remember the Warriors were up by 30 at halftime. I think I was still traveling at that point. Were you at that game?
I was. That was demolition. It was incredible. I haven't seen many things like that in a preseason game. And Doc was pissed after the game, not really at his own team, but at the Warriors for trying so hard.
That's not how I took that. I took that as they came out like they're willing to play a real game, and we didn't.
Just my interpretation of it, because I don't know. It was a preseason game. I thought it was fine. It was also a mid preseason game. Like, it wasn't one of those like right at the end when you're gearing up, all that sort of stuff. The Warriors had played some sloppy games right before it.
Well, it certainly wasn't as good as his tirade at the beginning of last year.
Oh my God.
When they, I think that might have been 2 years ago.
It was 2 years ago.
When the Warriors blew it, because the Clippers actually played them pretty close at Oracle at the beginning of last year. Anyway, that's enough on that. Twitter NBA show is going to be awesome. Can't wait to do it tomorrow. And so I think we will have that award show, probably schedule that to come out Thursday morning, let the Twitter NBA show marinate a little bit. So people who want to watch, find our take on the game can watch that on the rewatch first. We'll talk to you all soon. Don't forget about the June Oven too. JuneOven.com, CapSpace code, get you CapSpace code. We'll get you $100 off. Now we're done. Talk to you all soon.